Good morning.
Good morning.
So nice to have you all here in person for our kind of one-off Dudes and Duds Bible study, following up to Three Women and a Baby, which Julie Faith Parker spent the first 3 weeks of Advent leading us through. And she was amazing. She wants to come back, so good job, you all. She just had a blast with you, and I know that you had a blast with her. Welcome to those of you who are joining us via live stream. What you don't know is we were just having a spirited conversation about whether it was snowing in Bethlehem and all that sort of Christmas, did it really happen that way kind of talk. But let's jump in. I confess that I worked on this so many Christmas parties ago that I've forgotten some of what I put in here. So if there's a Christmas surprise, bear with me. Let's see what we do. So the idea is to look, we've looked at the kind of the amazing women, the strong female characters in the Christmas story. And this week is just kind of mopping up, looking at some of these guys who also get in there, and some of them, rather stupid, actually. And some of them are characters we maybe wish weren't in there. And Julie walked you through the Gospel of Luke, the early chapters in the Gospel of Luke, and this is going to be a look at the Gospel of Matthew. And it's going to start off in a very exciting way, high drama here. The Gospel of Matthew, I don't even know what I have here. This is just a little bit of background on the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, so probably written between 90 and 100 CE, roughly a contemporary with Luke, so around the same time. Luke was probably written a little bit later. It takes stories from the Gospel of Mark and adds on sermons and teachings of Jesus from Q. Julie talked about that, this kind of hype that sort of we imagine that there is a source of just things that Jesus said. And they gather together all these sayings and teachings and sermons, and they call it Q from the German word for source. And so that's what he, Matthew, adds on to the Gospel of Mark, some of this, written with a self-consciously Jewish Christian perspective. So there's a lot of concern to draw out the great themes of the Hebrew scriptures, to kind of bring them to bear upon the story of Jesus and their own understanding. So there's a lot of interaction with the Hebrew scriptures and a lot of concern to help this community understand their rootedness in the Jewish tradition. So that's a little bit of just Matthew. And then here's the high drama that I'm talking about, starting off with a bang, the genealogy. Right there, Matthew 1:1, doesn't get more exciting than this, right? I'm not going to read it all, don't worry. An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar, on and on and on, right? Now, I've bolded just a few of the kind of interesting, noteworthy aspects of this. You'll see Tamar, Rahab, Ruth in the second paragraph by the wife of Uriah, that's Bathsheba. There are women in this genealogy, and kind of scandalous women, mostly non-Israelite women from the Hebrew scriptures, outsider kind of questionable character women. And so it's just kind of interesting that they find their way in here, sort of as just kind of a nice follow-up to last week, where Luke kind of tells the stories of all these important women. Here, Matthew just gives us a little taste of some of the women that have gone before, the matriarchs that have paved the way for Christ. But mostly, they kind of play a supporting role here, and it's just working through generation after generation after generation of these guys, and culminates down here at the bottom with Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. So you see, it starts with Abraham up the top, and we work our way down to Joseph and Jesus that way. So all the generations are from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation of Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. So you can see roughly each of these big blocks are broken up into a span of about 14 generations, and that's how Matthew organizes the genealogy. All right, so genealogy divided into three groups of 14, and the numbering seems to be intentional. He omits three kings from the middle paragraph there, so the middle section equals the other. So already we can see this genealogy is not kind of a hard and fast historical record. He takes liberties with it, And he's intentionally grouping these names, whoever they were, into groups of 14. And the Hebrew letters, this is kind of, if you like that kind of decoding stuff, the Hebrew letters double as numbers. So the numerical value of the word David, and remember in Hebrew the consonants, there's only consonants, the values are kind of made up. So you get a D, a V, and a D, sort of in English. The D, you know, number 4, V, number 6, D, number 4, equals 14. So there's this kind of very implicit, you know, that might be just too cute for words, but there's this kind of sense to in very implicit ways, tie this the birth of Jesus, talk about who Jesus is in relation to this tradition of David and of Abraham. So I think that's kind of cool. What else about this genealogy? Okay, this is also kind of cool. An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, the word there, the Greek word for genealogy, is the same word as for Genesis. It's the Greek word for Genesis, and so you can read it, an account of the Genesis of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, where else do we know Genesis from? The book of Genesis, right? The first book of the Bible. And in the book of Genesis, we read the word Genesis a number of times, actually. So these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This is that kind of bridge between the first and the second creation story in Genesis 1. Genesis 2:4, the NRSV translates the Hebrew. But in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, it reads literally, the book of the Genesis of the heavens and the earth. So working with the Greek scriptures, most certainly Matthew was familiar with these, there would have been this kind of really interesting ping that would go off in maybe the imagination of the readers, tying the account of the Genesis of Jesus to the account of the Genesis of the heavens and earth, and then also in Genesis 5:1, the book of the Genesis of human beings, where it kind of lists out the descendants after Adam to get you up to Noah, I believe. So there is this, again, this kind of very subtle way with the language to kind of look backwards and to anchor and root the Jesus story and the birth of Jesus in these kind of amazing, important passages of Scripture. Any questions about that real quick? All right, riveting stuff, I know, high drama. Little bit more about the genealogy. Okay, so Joseph is not mentioned in the Gospel of Mark, and Mary is not mentioned by name in the Gospel of John. She is, you know, Jesus' mother obviously is mentioned. You know, think of the wedding at Cana in John 2, where the mother of Jesus says they've run out of wine, and he says, "Woman, what is that to me?" But John doesn't ever mention Mary by name. So just some Christmas Jesus mom and dad trivia for you there. The Gospel of Luke is the only other gospel that has a genealogy, but it's not the same as the one in the Gospel of Matthew. They cannot be harmonized. They're very different. Even Joseph's father is differently named. So you'd think, boy, can't even Jesus' grandfather, kind of, can't they get that right? But again, it was very likely, and this is not only in the Bible. In the ancient world, genealogies were not really thought to be, you know, it's not ancestry.com. It's not 23andMe. You know, it was people, how they told stories about their current reality, about and they would incorporate all these ancestors that kind of helped them tell the story about who they came to be. So it was selective. There was some design to it. Multiple genealogies would circulate for many famous characters in the ancient world. Jesus is just one of them. Yeah, down front. So don't freak out about that. It's not like a contradiction. It's just that's the way genealogies are. They are the way they are for specific reasons that have nothing to do with, you know, ancestry.com kind of stuff.
I was always taught that one was the genealogy of Mary, and the other one was the genealogy of Joseph.
Yeah, good. So there's a way you can read the Gospel of Luke that way. I don't think that's very. I think you can make that case that the Gospel of Luke is the genealogy of Mary. Joseph's still in there. It's not very. You could make that case, but you could also make a case that they're both genealogies through Joseph back. But that's kind of a handy way to look at it. So the genealogy in the Gospel of Luke works backwards from Jesus, not forward from the earliest ancestor. So you saw this one. Matthew starts with Abraham and kind of finishes with Jesus. Starts at the beginning, ends with the end. Luke, it's reversed. And Luke traces Jesus' genealogy, the lineage back to what? Does anybody know where?
Moses.
Nope. Farther back than that. Adam, yeah. So Luke goes back to the son of Enos, son of Seth, son of Adam, son of God. So really different, right? Luke wants to say Jesus ultimately is a descendant of God via Adam, and Matthew wants to say Jesus is a son of David and a son of Abraham. And so kind of the question for you is, why? I mean, why do you think these lineages, you know, the one goes to Adam and the other here, Matthew only goes to Abraham? Yeah. You can shout it out and I'll... Yeah, so there's a sense in which for Luke, maybe Jesus is the second Adam, this kind of the father of, you know, kind of the one who's the redeemer of all humankind. And the significance in the Gospel of Luke is Jesus has the whole world as the mission field, sort of. And what would that mean for Matthew's Gospel and tracing him just back to Abraham? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so again, trying to draw out that connection between the Jewish community and these kind of Jewish Christian followers of Jesus, helping them to understand the extent to which their Jewish identity is caught up in their following Jesus. And so that's why, again, sort of going back to just the father of the Jewish people, going back to Abraham, Matthew, again, draws out the Jewishness, the kind of that dimension of what's going on with the Jesus movement. I think one more thing about the genealogy. So why trace Jesus' lineage through Joseph anyway, right? I mean, Joseph's not his biological father. So this genealogy, it's really Joseph's genealogy, and Jesus is kind of tacked on to the end. So why even give us a genealogy like this when Jesus is not biologically descended by Joseph to these characters? Yeah.
Well, Joseph is his legal father.
Okay.
And Joseph is a descendant of David.
Yeah. So there's kind of a legal aspect. So whether or not you think about, again, biology, there is this kind of legal quality. Others, any kind of ideas there? Yeah.
To make him Jewish.
To make him Jewish. Okay. Well. Okay. Probably was Jewish anyway. You know, without a doubt. But I mean, it does emphasize that. I mean, that's the way to get him into the family tree. You know, for Matthew, this is from a guy named Douglas Hare. For Matthew, God's miraculous action in causing the pregnancy seemed to include the miraculous incorporation of the child into Joseph's family. Another way to say that more simply is, adoption is just as much a miracle as childbirth here. I think that's a beautiful kind of aside in this story, that there's something about incorporating Jesus into the family of Joseph, kind of giving him this legal entryway into the family of Joseph. And I think that's just a beautiful, often overlooked aspect of doing it that way, of really claiming Joseph as Jesus' father, even though he was not, in the tradition, his biological father, but that his paternity is as valid as any other paternity, which is, you know, obviously in the ancient world, they didn't do adoption the way we do it. But for those of us who have families that, you know, where adoption is part of our stories, I think this is a beautiful dimension of that. Just, yeah, you love it. Yeah. It counts.
Well, that would be born through the Spirit.
Yeah, born
through the Spirit. So yeah, man, born through man, born through women, and born through the Spirit.
Yeah, and I think there's something about, again, seeing the Spirit as at the miracle, right? The miracle of the Spirit's work in bringing about this child of God also is miraculously at work bringing this child to grow to this family where he will be raised. Thinking about the Spirit as, you know, involved with all that too. So let's look on after the genealogy. What happens next? Into the story. Okay. So the birth of Jesus the Messiah took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been engaged to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Her husband Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. But just when he had resolved to do this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. "Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God is with us." When Joseph awoke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife, but had no marital relations with her until she had borne a son, and he named him Jesus. All right, so especially if you've been here the past couple weeks, there are some pretty obvious ways that this is different from Luke's story. So just, what do you got? What do you see? What's different here? What's different than what you saw with the kind of the very familiar Christmas story we might get, you know, in a Christmas Eve service or something like that? We don't usually do Matthew, right, in the Christmas season, actually. It's rarely kind of the one that's preached or in the lessons and carol stuff. Yeah.
Well, there's no Gabriel. There's no angels. There's okay. No shepherds.
All right, so there's none of that.
No, looking for the inn.
There's no kind of, you can't really make much of a Christmas pageant out of this, right? I mean, you don't have any of that kind of the hoopla, you know, nothing like that. And so, yeah, John, what else?
That was where I was.
That was, you got, yeah, smaller cast of characters. What else? There's an annunciation here, but who gets it? Joseph, right? Not Mary. So the guy gets the annunciation here. So that's just, you know, kind of interesting. What else? Who names him? Joseph. Who names him in Luke?
Mary.
Mary, right? So again, this kind of guy-centric model. Just Joseph is the main character in this story, not Mary. Yeah, Chris.
It's okay. So I read what I found interesting about this, and this kind of just came to me. I heard this a while ago, a commentary on Joseph being a righteous man. Now, a righteous Hebrew man would have had to expose her.
Okay.
Because that was kind of the law, right?
Mm-hmm.
So could that have been kind of his kind of rebellion against the righteousness? Like, he was right. Like, this could read something like, in spite of him being a righteous man, but unwilling to expose her.
Yeah.
Like, so him being righteous is not necessarily equating exposing her.
Yeah, okay, good. So I'm picking up what you're putting out, and we'll come back to it in 2 minutes, I promise, because I've got it on here, and that's a great point. So, Diane.
I'm coming. So can we assume from this that Matthew is more of the patriarchy than Luke is?
Yeah, I mean, right, he's not going to the women's march, probably. You know, not that Luke would either, but I mean, right, Julie talked about it. You can it's not uncomplicated to try to think about how, you know, women are portrayed positively in the Gospel of Luke. You can nuance that in some negative ways, but certainly there's a little more to work with than in the Gospel of Matthew. So just a few more things about Joseph, our main character here. Yeah. Carol, right?
Yep.
All right, got it.
Bethlehem in the census?
Okay, good. No Bethlehem in the census. So if we have time, we'll come back to that at the very end. But you'll notice, where are we here? There's no mention of Bethlehem really here, right? So hang on to your hats with that. Hang on to your hats for the end. Okay, so a little bit about Joseph, our main character. He's a dreamer, right? He's having these kind of amazing dreams, these epiphanies in his dreams. Who else from the Old Testament do we know who had dreams? Okay, Joseph and, you know, Jacob, right? Jacob and the ladder up to heaven with Jacob's ladder, you know, the famous spiritual and all of that. So tying him into that tradition. And then, of course, Joseph, who's got his dreams about how he's, you know, going to be more important than everyone else in his family, more than his brothers, more than his parents and all that. And then ultimately, right, ends up kind of working for Pharaoh, interpreting dreams. He's called the master of dreams, the dream master. Isn't that a cool, you know, who wouldn't want to be the dream master? So again, part of what we're supposed to see when we see Joseph is where our minds are supposed to go, oh, yeah, it's kind of like that other guy who knew a thing or two about dreams and who kind of provided for his people. Now back to Chris's point. Her husband Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. That's verse 19. So according to the law, in Deuteronomy 22, Joseph could have turned Mary over to the authorities to be stoned. That was his legal right to do so. And there, the law in that part of Deuteronomy, it's actually very interesting. If sort of, presumably you'd have to be found in the act or something, but you could, if this happened in the city, the man and the woman who were guilty of this kind of, kind of sexual impropriety, they would be both stoned. And if it happened in the country, the woman would not be stoned and just the man would be. And why do you think that, what's the difference there? It's kind of just interesting truth. Okay, so hang on to that. Yeah. Okay, yeah, we can talk about that. So just really quickly about the Deuteronomy, the law there. The reason why, you know, an adulteress wouldn't be stoned in the country if they found her out in the wilderness, you know, is because theoretically it could have been involuntary. It could have been forced, and she would cry out for help, but nobody would hear her. So she was given the benefit of the doubt that she wouldn't have wanted this. But in the city, she could have cried out, and neighbors would have heard her and come to her aid. But if she, you know, I guess that nobody thought maybe you could do this. But in any event, this was kind of the legal background for Joseph in the Deuteronomic law. However, there was a tradition by this point, I mean, kind of the more common practice. There's also, we don't have a lot of evidence that this was ever done. There's very little evidence, almost no evidence to suggest that they went around actively stoning people. And one of the only really piece of evidence we have is the story where Jesus kind of seems to butt in on it, and which is just interesting, that the only story about one of these things that we have is a story of it not actually happening. But at any rate, it was common at this point where the husband or the fiance kind of character could, the woman could just admit, you know, I'm defiled, and they could just call it a day, and she could go her way. There is some early rabbinic kind of writing to that effect. The law had kind of morphed already to the point where this was really not customary. Whether that meant Joseph would bring Mary, just kind of say, let's just kind of, whether that was what it was, where she had to appear before someone, a priest, I don't know, and kind of say, you know, I'm defiled in this way. It's not clear. The story doesn't say. But certainly, you know, I think what's interesting and important about it is he's characterized as just but also merciful. There's this balance where we see in Joseph, he's concerned to do the right thing, to honor the law, but he's also concerned for Mary and concerned for kind of living the law, not legalistically, but with an eye to its true intent, which is mercy and compassion. So that's a little bit about Joseph. Anything else just about this part of the story? So the engagement bit. Right, so I know a lot of you know this via Sister Carol, right? But if you're engaged, you're basically already married. There wasn't any kind of here comes the bride and all of that. You would kind of the husband to be would make a deal with the bride's parents, the father really, and they would agree on a price and all that. And she would stay living at home with her parents until such and such a time when they were ready to seal the deal. And he had made a house for her and created a place, probably added on a room to his parents' house. And then she would go and live with them, and that was kind of done. Then the marriage was done. They'd finalize the dowry and all that. And that was it. So they're kind of in this limbo stage between where they've already agreed, they've probably already paid some money, the Mary's family to Joseph, and they're kind of just waiting for him to finish building on the addition to get Mary into her new home. And so she is, sort of in her father's house, and really would have been kept kind of under guard. Women were, you know, in this considered vulnerable in this position. Their honor was very, it was kind of attended to. And so it would be all the more remarkable then that she would have been thought to be pregnant, given that she would probably never have been alone with another man. Very, very unusual. So any questions about that? Just that engagement bit. Yeah. They would probably pay,
He paid it. So was that customary for the spouse or
No, I'm sorry, the family would have paid Joseph. The family would have
would
paid.
Would have paid Joseph.
To take her off his hands.
Oh.
Right? Not great. So, that was more the custom.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Plowing on. All right, John, yeah.
World. If he had been born illegitimately?
Yeah. Okay.
So he had to have legitimacy. So somebody had to claim him and name him.
Yeah, that's interesting. In the Gospels, there's this taunt, actually. I mean, he's off, you'll think about it, where they say, oh, is this Joseph's son? You can find places in the Gospels where he seemed to be taunted that way. And, you know, some scholars say this is because he was thought to be illegitimate, and people would kind of to say, oh, you're Joseph's son, aren't you? That was to kind of say, you know, yeah, not really. You know, that this was sort of that Jesus grew up as a stigmatized child who was thought to be illegitimate, and that... And, you know, I think there's something beautiful about that, too, if that's in fact the case, that those taunts that we have in the scriptures were actually taunts, then I think, you know, to me think about all the kids that we know in this church and in our lives who have a really hard time at school, right, who really struggle, who kind of bear up under this bullying, all the reasons that people might grow up just being taunted, and that they turn that pain into energy, into healing energy, and help other people with it. You know, I think that, I mean, there's a really beautiful article that makes this claim that only somebody who's lived with that kind of pain and kind of lived under that growing up would know how to help other people deal with their pain. And that part of what made Jesus so kind of astonishingly compassionate was his own personal experiences growing up in this family that was tainted by scandal. So whether or not you buy that or not, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. So let's kind of jump ahead a little bit. Moving on the story, okay, more guys, more dudes, this time bad dudes, right? In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men, magi, came from the east, came to Jerusalem asking, where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? We have observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. When King Herod heard this, he was frightened and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod secretly called for the wise men, the Magi, and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may go and pay him homage. When they heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising until it stopped over the place where the child was, in Bethlehem. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chest, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. So just here to your point, Carol, I mean, so they have a house in Bethlehem. So if you're really careful and reading carefully here, you know, in the Gospel of Matthew, it seems to appear that the Holy Family lives in Bethlehem, that they have a house there where they've been staying there. And it's common here that Jesus is actually, you know, traditionally thought to be a child by this point, that he's grown up a few years, that it's taken some time for all of this to play out. So again, that's interesting. Whereas in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus, you know, they're from Nazareth and they go to Bethlehem. So the problem is how to account for the fact that Jesus had to be born in Bethlehem to fulfill these kind of prophecies, but everybody knew he was from Nazareth and he grew up in Nazareth. So they've got to find a way to tell that story, to handle what's Jesus' connection to Bethlehem, how did he get there, what's his connection to Nazareth, how did he get there. So we'll see how Matthew kind of pulls this off. Okay, so about this. Herod the Great, what do you need to know about him? Not a nice guy. Appointed king of the Jews by the Roman Senate in 40 BC. Took control of Jerusalem in about 37 BC. He was looked upon with suspicion by the Pharisees, who regarded him as a foreigner from Edom with a penchant for irreligious pomposity and extravagance. So we always think of the Pharisees as kind of the bad guys in the Gospels, but they were actually like they were more liberal. That's probably the wrong word, but they were mostly lay people who were really concerned that the priests don't have a monopoly on what it meant to follow God. And so the Pharisees were these very intense kind of church people, you know, maybe like you, and they thought, you know, they were really concerned with kind of doing things the right way and not just trusting the pastor to know everything. And so they were very pious, and they had very strong opinions about what kind of religion should look like, and they thought that Herod was kind of lived too luxurious a lifestyle, and it affronted their kind of sense of simplicity, the simplicity that would be befitting of a deeply religious person. He commissioned massive building projects, many fortresses, a port, and renovations at the Jerusalem temple. very mentally unstable. He murdered his wife and other family members, died in 4 CE, at which time his kingdom was divided between his sons. All right, so that's Herod. And the question is, who are the Magi? What's going on with them, right? I think the best kind of way to think about what the Magi mean in this story is to go back to the book of Numbers, a very often overlooked little story, but one of the funniest stories in the Bible, the story of Balak and Balaam. So here it is. Here's, I think, the best parallel to the Magi we have that helps us to see how we're to understand them. Okay, Balak, son of Zippor, was a king of Moab at that time. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor, which is on the Euphrates, in the land of Ammah, to summon him, saying, okay, listen up. A people has come out of Egypt. They have spread over the face of the earth. They have settled next to me. Come now and curse this people for me, since they are stronger than I. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that whomever you bless is blessed, and whomever you curse is cursed. Okay? So here's a king living in Canaan. He sees, you know, Israel kind of spreading out, taking over the Holy Land, and he says, ah, I got to stop these people, but they have a bigger army than me, so I'm going to kind of hire this soothsayer, kind of a mercenary, you know, kind of magician, and bring him in, and he's going to curse the Israelites because he doesn't have the army to do it himself. Okay, so Balaam, this kind of magician for hire, comes in. Okay, so and he talks with the king for a while, and then Balaam is kind of consulting his oracles. And Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord, though, to bless Israel. So he kind of was getting the feeling in his kind of consulting his oracles that, you know, yes, I've been hired to curse Israel, but really I think God wants me to bless them. You know, he does that. He blesses them first three times, and then Balak's, the king's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. Balak, the king, said to Balaam, I summoned you to curse my enemies, but instead you have blessed them these three times. Now be off with you, go home. Okay, so here's this kind of wise, magical, diviner character who is brought in by a kind of a wicked king to deal with kind of a threat to his reign and his kingdom. And this kind of visitor, this kind of guy, the outside guy, the pagan who comes in, he ultimately ends up not being able to meet those expectations of the evil king. And Balaam said to Balak, so now I'm going to my people, but let me advise you what this people will do to your people in days to come. So he gets one last word in, this kind of magician for hire, and he gives them an oracle. The oracle of Balaam, the oracle of the man whose eye is clear, the oracle of the one who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty. All right, he says, I see him, I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the borderlands of Moab. And so the last oracle that this kind of foreign magician, wise guy gives sort of says the star is going to rise out of the house of Jacob, and that's going to mean the end to kind of these other peoples. The word about the star shall rise, I mean, that's set to many choral pieces, star shall come out of Jacob. It was thought to be about David. The Jewish people mostly thought this was a prophecy about David. Then it became a prophecy of the Messiah, the star coming out of Jacob. But there's some really important, did you catch the similarities between the Magi and Balaam? So Herod is likened to King Balak and the Magi to the pagan seer Balaam. He's a pagan seer summoned from the eastern mountains in Numbers 23:7. We didn't read that part, but here's this pagan guy who comes from the east, just like the Magi, right? He's described by Philo of Alexandria as a magos, as basically a Magi, in his kind of reflections on the text. He's called upon to serve a wicked king, and he frustrates his evil plans. So that's, I think, the best way to think about the Magi, probably invoking this story, invoking this kind of drama between them. All right, so then they had left, they go, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, another dream, and said, get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, out of Egypt I have called my son. Again, Joseph is kind of likened to his great ancestor, Joseph, another dreamer who sojourns in Egypt, right? This isn't the first Joseph who goes down to Egypt that we know about in the Bible. So let's see what we got here. All right. Herod saw that he'd been tricked. He's mad. He sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. This is why they think Jesus was about 2 years old by this point, living in a house in Bethlehem. We don't need to read that. So Herod dies. An angel says, okay, now it's safe for you. Go to the land of Israel. Those who are seeking the child's life are dead. So again, what other story about killing a bunch of... Pharaoh. So again, here, the Exodus story. A new king arose who didn't know Joseph. The Israelites are powerful. He eventually, at the end here, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women, he tells these two midwives, if it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, she shall live. So trying to stamp out the people, killing all the newborn Israelite babies. A very famous story, right? In very clear ways, this is what we're supposed to see Herod as kind of this new Pharaoh. He's an oppressive tyrant whose paranoia drives him to mass murder. And Jesus, like Moses, will be saved through a marvelous kind of intervention. He's also told to return home, for all the men who were seeking your life are now dead, right? This verse from Matthew is kind of a direct pull out of the Exodus story. So Jesus is in some way kind of characterized as this new Moses, this new wise teacher, this new one who's going to lead and deliver a people into liberation from bondage, right? Which is a powerful way to think about what Jesus meant to people, who he is, right? He gives the law. Think about what Moses does. He gives the law, right? Goes up on a mountain and gives the law. What does Jesus do, right? Goes up onto the mount and gives the sermon. A lot of the sermon, which is talking about how to do the law in a really intense, beautiful new way. Jesus, you know, is a liberator, like Moses, frees people from whatever bondage they're in. So a powerful parallel. Yeah, John.
There's one little line that escaped me for many years, but I caught a few years ago in Sister Carol's class that says, Mary went to visit her cousin Elizabeth, who was descended from Aaron, who was Moses' brother. Does that mean that Mary was also descended from Moses?
You know what? Let's just save that, because that'll go on a tangent, and that's in the Luke stuff. So, just a lot of going back to this story. I want to give you... a little bit about this. There, around the time that the gospel was written, there was a lot of reflection in the Jewish community on Moses, and there were these kind of, we would talk about apocryphal kind of reflections, embellishments of the story. So here's an annunciation story, but to Miriam, kind of adding on to the Exodus story. The Spirit of God came upon Miriam one night, and she saw a dream and told it to her parents in the morning, saying, I've seen this night, behold, a man in a linen garment, probably like an angel, stood and said to me, go and say to your parents, behold, he who will be born from you will be cast forth into the water. Likewise, through him, the water will be dried up, and I will work signs through him and save my people. He will exercise leadership always. So here's again this sort of sense that somebody has a dream, and in the dream, they see that this great leader is going to affect this kind of liberation. Here's another one, just like this, same time. This is Josephus. One of the sacred scribes, persons with considerable skill in accurately predicting the future, announced to the king that there would be born to the Israelites at that time one who would abase the sovereignty of the Egyptians and exalt the Israelites were he reared to manhood and would surpass all men in virtue and win everlasting renown. Right? So again, here's this other guy, this other kind of sense that somebody's kind of reading the tea leaves and goes to the king, goes to the wicked king and says, look, there's a baby that's going to be born and he's going to upset your whole kingdom. You better do something about it. Right? This is basically the same thing as in the Jesus story, right? I mean, this is that passage from Matthew. Herod has the kind of reading the tea leaves and says, this baby's going to really be the end of me. Right? And so what's interesting is, I mean, at the time that the Gospels were written, there was all this reflection about who Moses is, and they're kind of embellishing the story that way. So the biblical narrative of Moses' birth, it was embellished freely in the time of the Gospel of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew appears to know about this tradition of reflection, and it kind of integrates it into the story of Jesus' birth. So we've talked about that. What's the significance of portraying Jesus as the second Moses? I mean, that's kind of at the heart of this. That they would then also, presumably in the Christian community, when they think about Moses, when they read the stories of Moses, they're then thinking about Jesus, too. Drawing this parallel, it goes both ways for them. Jesus kind of becomes this kind of lawgiver, this liberator. And now, as Christians, we kind of look back at Moses, and we see, you know, we kind of interpret him through the lens of Jesus. That was kind of what Matthew was doing, was tying him to all these guys who've gone before, and tying all the kind of... In, kind of creating this cast of characters around him, all these bad guys and the good guys, right, the Magi, who come right out of the Jewish tradition. Any last thoughts, any questions about that?
1 minute.
1 minute. All right, well, let me give you a parting gift then. Back to Carol. Okay, so this is when they made their way home to a town of Nazareth. So after they come out of Egypt, they go to Nazareth, right? We talked about how they actually lived in Bethlehem, but then they go down to Egypt, and then on their way back up, then they move to Nazareth after they flee to Egypt because they don't like Herod's son who's ruling in the area of Bethlehem now, okay? And so this, though, is from, we saw that. In Luke, though, right, they went from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And so the deal is Matthew has to move the Holy Family from Bethlehem to Nazareth. Luke needs to get them from Nazareth to Bethlehem. They make this kind of reverse trick, right? So for Matthew, the flight to Egypt is how he gets them from one place to another. Luke, it's the census. So the census and the kind of the flight to Egypt, these stories in some way, they really are kind of, they are what it takes to be able to honor the tradition of Jesus being born in Bethlehem but raised in Nazareth. So if that helps you, if you don't like the slaughter of the innocents thing, if you think, why is this in the Bible? There's no evidence that it really happened, you know? And really, it's kind of incorporated here because it kind of moves the story along in the way that it needs to. I think that's fun, cool. Merry Christmas, you know? Enjoy, yeah. And as a reminder, there's no gathering next week, but Nina Frost and Elise will be kind of tag teaming the first 2 weeks of January. Boy, that's scary. And then we're going to do 3 weeks on the Exodus story. So after all this kind of looking backwards, we'll spend some time with that story again. And then we've got a guest coming in after that for a couple weeks. So more to come.
And don't forget to join us on Christmas Eve, folks. We'd love to see you. There will be the Bible told there, too.